You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, students at UW-Green Bay are looking for ways to improve the quality of life for aging Wisconsinites, and they're in a competition to find the best ideas. We'll find out what's in the works. Now it's a pivotal week for American politics. People in Georgia will be voting in two U.S. Senate races that will determine which party controls the chamber over the next 2 years. Joe Biden is also set to hit another milestone on the way to Inauguration Day, but a growing number of Republicans say they'll object to certain states' electoral college votes. Among them, Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson. He defended his position yesterday on NBC's Meet the Press.
Let's take a look at a bipartisan commission to organize all the allegations. Certainly what I did in my hearing. It was a 3.5-hour hearing. We barely scratched the surface, but organize the allegations. Let's take off the table the ones that have been explained, but also acknowledge the problem areas that have not been explained so that we can restore confidence in our election system. This is an unsustainable state of affairs right now.
The GOP challenge to the Electoral College is expected to fail. Meanwhile, Democrats are accusing President Trump of abusing his power after he pressed Georgia's Secretary of State to overturn the state's presidential election result. And the new Congress was sworn in last night with Nancy Pelosi narrowly winning a fourth term as House Speaker. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you watching closely these Senate races in Georgia? What are you thinking? What are you feeling about them? What do you want to see as the result? Do you support the effort from Republicans, including Ron Johnson, to contest the results of the Electoral College? Do you worry that it's going to cause significant harm to democracy? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Andra Gillespie is an associate professor of political science at Emory University in Atlanta. Andra, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start in your backyard. A lot going on in Georgia with these Senate races. First of all, two runoffs here in the state. Now, people might be thinking, wait, we just do one Senate race at a time. How do we end up with two in Georgia right now?
Georgia had its regularly scheduled Senate race in the 2020 cycle. And then because we had a senator retire early because of health problems, his seat was up for a special election, so his replacement had been appointed, but she had to stand for election in a special election. And under Georgia law, if a candidate doesn't win an outright majority of the votes cast, then the top two vote-getters move on to a runoff election. That happened, and so we ended up with two runoffs.
Watching from here in Wisconsin, it looks like you're getting a lot of attention down in Georgia. Can you just kind of set the scene for us, the hullabaloo, the early voting, and then leading up to the in-person voting tomorrow?
While the election campaign for you may have ended on November 3rd, it hasn't ended yet for us here in Georgia, and it won't end until tomorrow. So Georgia went into early voting on December 14th. That lasted through New Year's Eve. We have had campaign ads since the November election, and so that's not going to go away until tomorrow either. And in between that, people have gotten phone calls, visits to their house, lots of mailers. There's just been a ton of activity. It may as well be the last week of October for us.
Now, for my expert reading of the polling and early voting numbers and things like that, Andra, I have no idea what's going to come out of tomorrow. Do I have it about right? Like, it's really hard to predict.
The race is statistically too close to call. The polls are too close. And turnout has been record-breaking so far. So to just put this into perspective, 5 million people cast ballots in the presidential election in November. And the last time there was a Senate runoff election was in 2008, and there about 2 million people voted in that runoff election. As of New Year's Eve, 3 million people had already cast their ballots in the Senate runoff election, and so we could easily top 4 million by tomorrow. We'll see, but we'll be somewhere in that vicinity, we think. So it's going to be close, and whoever wins is probably going to win by a pretty narrow margin.
Talking to Andra Gillespie from Emory University in Atlanta, looking at some of the big stories in national politics, many of them Georgia-centric right now. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions about the Senate race there and about this Wednesday's vote in Congress, this usual formality to confirm the vote of the Electoral College, 800-642-1234. Let's stay for the moment in Georgia. Andra, on Saturday, President Trump made a call to your Secretary of State there, Brad Raffensperger, urging him to, in effect, overturn Joe Biden's victory in the state. The Secretary of State's office recorded that conversation, released it, they said, after the president had made false claims about what happened in that conversation. Here is a listen to some of what the president had to say here.
Well, under law, you're not allowed to give faulty election results, okay? You're not allowed to do that, and that's what you've done. This is a faulty election result. And honestly, this should go very fast. You should meet tomorrow, because you have a big election coming up. And because of what you've done to the president, you know, the people of Georgia know that this was a scam. And because of what you've done to the president, a lot of people aren't going out to vote. And a lot of Republicans are going to vote negative because they hate what you did to the president. Okay? They hate it. And they're going to vote. And if you would be respected, if really respected, if this thing could be straightened out before the election. You have a big election coming up on Tuesday.
Andra, what's your read on this phone call? It's getting a lot of attention.
Well, I mean, it is scandalous, but it's not terribly surprising. No candidate should be calling up an elections official and telling them to go find votes to help them win an election. No candidate should be calling up an elections official and making what could arguably be thinly veiled threats. But at the same time, President Trump has actually been doing it pretty publicly since the end of the November election. And so, you know, in your state, you've experienced it as well. And so he's lobbied legislators. He has, tried to berate elections officials. And so he's done this pretty repeatedly. It's just that seemed to be very, very pointed. And also just the fact that we're getting so close to Inauguration Day and that this is still happening. I think that probably is what stands out. But at the end of the day, he's been doing this, for a long period of time, and he's still looking for that in where he might be able to, be able to find some type of grounds to be able to reverse the election results that have already, been, cast in the Electoral College and that are going to be certified on Wednesday, even with the planned Republican protest.
Let's go to our callers now and turning to the topic of expected challenges in Congress as they go through the, again, usual formality of accepting the Electoral College outcome. Let's start with Rick in Rhinelander. Rick, hi.
Yes, hello. Yes, I'd like to make a comment. You played that clip from Chuck Todd's interview. I'd like to point out that Chuck Todd mentioned that the reason that the electorate had concerns was because people like Senator Johnson continued to repeat the fiction put forth by the president that there were some irregularities. Over 60 cases have been tried in our court system, including in front of Trump appointee judges, that have found no evidence of widespread voter fraud. And the reason is there is no evidence. So instead, what people like Senator Johnson do is argue this in the court of public opinion. And I'd like to point out that in a conversation with a former Green County Republican chairman, Senator Johnson acknowledged to that individual that he knew Biden was a legitimate president-elect and that simply it would be political suicide for him to go against the president's wishes to continue this charade.
Rick, thanks a lot for the call. Senator Johnson has challenged that presentation of the conversation, but the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reshared quotes from the senator apparently saying he was not going to challenge the election this week. He has since changed his mind. Andra, a lot of Republicans in the House and Senate saying they're going to challenge states like Wisconsin and others and their Electoral College slates. What comes out of that?
I think it's a lot of symbolic politics. They know that the votes don't exist in the House and in the Senate to change the certification of the Electoral College results. And so this is going to be the final sort of step in the official process of moving Joe Biden towards the inauguration on January 20th. But Donald Trump is still going to be the titular head of the Republican Party even after Joe Biden is sworn in as President of the United States. And his endorsement carries a lot of sway. And what people don't want is him getting on Twitter and, you know, calling for a primary challenge against Republican candidates. So what it's going to take in order to stop that is, you know, a critical mass of Republican members of Congress and governors who will stand up to President Trump and say, you know what, even if you do endorse my opponent, even if you do push for a primary challenge, I'm still going to oppose you when I feel that it's the right thing to do. Senator Johnson and others need to remember that they will still be employed by the American people on January 21st, and Donald Trump will not.
Thanks for the call, Rick. We're talking about the latest on congressional and presidential politics with Andra Gillespie, Associate Professor of Political Science at Emory University in Atlanta. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see come out of the U.S. Senate races in Georgia? Are you watching them closely? What do you think about the plan by some Republicans in the House and Senate to challenge the Electoral College certification? What do you think of President Trump's call to Georgia's Secretary of State, asking him to find the votes to overturn Joe Biden's win in the state? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the drama in Georgia and Washington, D.C. Two Senate races in Georgia, President Trump's phone call to Georgia's Secretary of State, and the push by some Republicans, including Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson, to challenge the certification of the Electoral College. Andra Gillespie with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at Emory University. And you are with us at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to our callers now. Willem is with us in Colfax. Willem, hello.
Hello. I'm 70 years old, almost 70 years old, and I've never witnessed anything like this in our country where the President of the United States, without, you know, it's said that the United States is a country of laws, not men, and the rule of law requires evidence. And if you can't come up with the evidence, you can't just go accusing, you know, the foundation of our democracy as being corrupt without any evidence. If that's not an impeachable offense or a high crime, then what is? And our Senator Ron Johnson, I think we haven't had a senator like Ron Johnson since Joe McCarthy, someone who is willing to perpetuate a pure and unproven fiction and almost bring down our government. He said that with Chuck Todd that there were tens of thousands of people who were upset about the election. That's the way it is in a democracy. We have winners and losers. I've been upset about elections, but it doesn't mean that the election was a fraud. It means that my candidate didn't win.
Willem, thanks a lot for the call. Andra, Willem, bringing up a point that others share, worried that these challenges to the election, accusations without evidence of widespread fraud, might damage the system in the short and long run. Do you have that concern?
I share the concern. What we're concerned about is the precedent and the optics. And also, you know, I think what, you know, people are concerned about is the vacuum of leadership. So, you know, clearly we are in an era now where facts are contingent, but they don't have to be contingent. And it's up to leaders, and we look to our elected leaders to sort of fill this role, that if people are going to peddle in misinformation, if constituents are going to sort of insist on things that are wrong, that people who are better informed and in a position to know better should stand up, even if it costs them votes, and say, you know, the facts that you have at your disposal are not actually facts and not true. And let me explain to you, you know, what's wrong here. And you don't have to agree with me at the end about the outcome of what we should do next, but here are the common basis of facts. And we don't see elected leaders stepping up and taking that particular role. So, you know, the only thing that I could, you know, tell your listeners to do if they're concerned about this is to register those concerns with the elected officials that they think are not actually taking their leadership position. And if those elected officials aren't responsive to that, then, you know, it may be time to consider other people for those positions.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to Jack now in Eau Claire. Jack, hi.
Hi. I wonder if your guest read the article by Chris Truax in USA Today yesterday.
What was it? Can you sum it up for us, Jack? We just have a few minutes left.
The title was basically something like, you know, Trump's shenanigans show the weaknesses in our electoral system. Anyhow, it's an excellent article, and it basically says it's given a blueprint to somebody else in the future that wants to pull this. If Trump had had both houses of Congress, who knows what would be happening now?
Jack, thanks a lot for the call. I've seen similar arguments. Haven't read that one myself. Andra is saying that, hey, maybe this is time to take out some of the gray areas in the process between Election Day and Inauguration Day, and worries that Jack brought up that in a slightly different situation, you know, things could go a different way and election could be overturned. Do we need to revisit some of our rules here?
I think that there's lots that we need to revisit. No, I haven't read the article that your listener brought up, but it's funny. If you go back and you read Trump's The Art of the Deal, he tells the story about how he got the variances in order to build Trump Tower as big as he did. And one of the things that he kind of brags about was that because he used every loophole he possibly could to make that building as big as possible, New York City actually had to go back and change its zoning laws after the fact. And so love him or hate him, Donald Trump has exposed weaknesses that it's now our responsibility to shore up.
Thanks for that call. In our last minute or so, Andra, what are you watching for on Wednesday as this, again, usual formality comes before Congress to approve the Electoral College?
So, you know, the biggest thing that I'm paying attention to tomorrow, you know, in Georgia is what Election Day turnout is going to look like. We suspect that more Democrats than Republicans turned out to vote in the early voting period and cast absentee ballots. So if we have a really strong turnout tomorrow, that could even the race up, and then it's just going to be a question of who wins. I don't know who's going to win, but it's going to be a close election.
Andra, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thank you.
Andra Gillespie is an associate professor of political science at Emory University in Atlanta. We talked with her about the Georgia U.S. Senate races, the Republican push to challenge the Electoral College certification, and other big issues in national politics. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a dream about hibernation. The story was written a couple years ago, but in the midst of the pandemic, it may be more relevant now than ever.
Some animals hibernate to survive the winter. Humans aren't included in that group, but that hasn't stopped writer Krista Eastman from imagining her perfect winter abode.
Before natural historians understood that some birds fly thousands of miles south each winter, they looked for other ways to explain their disappearance. Birds were like snakes, they suggested, burrowing for themselves a hibernaculum, an earthy pocket in which to pass the winter. Under the ground, the robin slumbered, her heart beating once in a while, her open throat not tweeting at all, her feathers caked in grit. This was another way to survive the winter, digging in, admitting no one, waiting for this too to pass. Deep into the winter blues, I awake to early morning darkness and wonder, is there really no other place for people and animals to live? Is there no other way? Some people are practical in coping with the season. Swift in booking cheap flights to Florida, they do not hesitate, they do not dally, they just depart. I am a member of that other tribe, those who dig in, those who let their thoughts grow warped on the grayest light of winter. At some point, usually around January 14th, I surrender to the season. My most insignificant problems begin to appear to me as uncontainable irritations, crosswords I'm much too grumpy to solve. It's hard, then, not to fantasize about my own hibernaculum, how I'd stock mine with a 5-month supply of coffee, chocolate, cheese, and wine to be consumed in that order every day, all winter long. Add to that a pile of books and a landline that only dials out for delivery. This would be the season of slow and silent contemplation, moderate melancholy, little to no exercise. A wise friend of mine claims this is what winter is for, a natural slowing down, a time to reflect, a not-so-unhealthy space for feeling a little bit sad. If it were possible, I think I'd also loft my hibernaculum in a tree and make of it a warm and protected nest. And then I'd also probably appoint someone responsible for yanking open the nest trap door once spring had truly come. I'd fall to the ground in an unwashed heap, stand up, blink my eyes. I imagined then that my pitying neighbors would gather round to watch as I stood for the first time in months, stretching muscles, cracking joints. She smells even worse than last year, one of them might mutter, as I crab walk off to the lake for a bracing spring rinse. But I won't do any of that, of course, not really. I will climb out of bed when my son wakes each morning. I will be on time for work. I will remember to bring home that carton of eggs. But someday I will also emerge vainglorious from winter's pocket. It will be suddenly warm, and I will be suddenly awake, and soon, my naked ankles frisky from sun, I'll wonder, what could be better than here? What way is there but this? Krista Eastman's essays have appeared in the Georgia Review, the Kenyon Review, and other journals. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit our website at wisconsinlife.org and find us on Facebook and on Twitter. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, aging comes with some new obstacles, and young people are trying to help solve those problems. We'll talk with the founder of a competition for innovative ideas to help boost the quality of life for seniors. By the way, we're having a conversation about exercise and fitness tomorrow, and you can get us started right now over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Our guest says that motivation is overrated when it comes to getting exercise. She says we need to build exercise and fitness into our lives, our habits, and our routines. So here's my question for you. Have you done that? Were you a not exercise person who became an exercise person? How did you do it? How did you fit it into your day? How did you find something that worked for you? Love to hear your answers. Maybe learn from them for myself. You can, again, do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas@WPR.org. Share your thoughts. We can use them on the show tomorrow. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, if you've been looking to get a more hands-on hobby, like maybe knitting, but you haven't made the leap, a UW-Madison professor has an easy way for you to make things without the learning curve. Now, a debit card designed specifically for safe use by older people, a hearing aid that could detect when someone's having a medical emergency and call 911. Those are just a couple of the past winners of the WISIS Innovation in Aging Student Idea Competition. The annual contest taking place next month is meant to generate ideas to help improve the quality of life for Wisconsin's growing population of elderly residents. Susan Gallagher-Lepak is a founder of the competition. She's dean of the College of Health, Education, and Social Welfare at UW-Green Bay. Susan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Pleasure to be with you.
Well, you've been at this for some years now. What was the original inspiration for this competition?
Oh, good question. Well, actually, we took great inspiration from a competition at the Stanford University Longevity Center. They had a aging design challenge that they still run. They're in about their eighth year of running the competition, and it's open to university students from really all around the world. And a colleague and I really locked into this idea, and the colleague was from Norway, and as you may know about Norway, they're really innovative around aging issues. And so the combination of kind of the inspiration from the Stanford competition and my colleague's, you know, knowledge from Norway, this was just a no-brainer to jump into this competition and try to have it occur at UW-Green Bay.
So for students who get involved, and I understand a good number of UW-Green Bay students get involved, what is their charge? What is the challenge to them when they join the competition?
Yeah, well, we're really looking for students that want to think creatively. The mission at UW-Green Bay is one where we really highlight problem-focused learning opportunities for students. And those opportunities can be in the classroom or outside of the classroom. So this particular challenge is really has students take on real-world challenges for older adults and think about how to creatively come up with a better solution, quite frankly. And in the process, in the work that they do look critically at their solution, existing solutions, and why their solution would be better. And so we really think that it helps train students to improve their skills in problem solving, idea development, communication of their ideas.
And a big part of the demographic, of course, that's doing this is going to be younger people, college undergraduates. Is part of the challenge here for them to, you know, look at people in a different life circumstance than themselves, understand, empathize, I guess, with challenges they may face and think outside of themselves a little bit?
Well, that's really what happens. You know, often students think they don't know a lot about aging or that the theme sort of constricts their thinking. But what happens as they go along is exactly that. They think outside of themselves. They observe the real world in a different way. One student, for example, was at dinner and noticed that his girlfriend's father had a tremor when he was eating and drinking. And that was really the inspiration for him for his solution and an idea in the competition. So really looking at the world differently, talking to older people, talking to their grandparents, trying to understand a bit more about what some of the areas are in aging that may present challenges. And it you know, it can be from a wide variety of areas. It can be about leisure or physical ability or cognitive ability or social endeavors. So really an opportunity to learn, and often they may have an idea and then they really push it beyond as they learn more about aging challenges.
Talking to Susan Gallagher-Lepak from UW-Green Bay, talking about a competition there for students to come up with plans to help people deal with various challenges of aging, and that can cover a lot of ground, as Susan was just saying. I briefly gave a capsule summary of a couple of the things that have come out of this. Can you share some more things that have come out of past competitions, some of the ideas we've seen from students?
Well, ideas are all over the board, really. Some students have come up with products, so devices, you know, I gave the cup example, or a grabber device, or, you know, some kind of device, or a health monitoring device. Actually, one person came up with a particular kind of sock that would be a good product for older adults. But it isn't limited to products. It can be social approaches. We had one group that did a anti-aging campaign as the innovation that they presented in the competition. Or it could be an environmental design or redesign idea. We had one group that had a cupboard system that made it easier for older people. So really all over the board. And we make it very clear that it really isn't just about developing a product. And so lots of room for students to work within those parameters.
Well, 2020 has been different, and 2021 still in a lot of ways because of the pandemic. How is that affecting how these students, and these are teams of students usually, how they tackle these projects?
Yeah, well, I think this year COVID may infiltrate into the competition and various solutions that students come up with. You know, certainly social distancing and ways to communicate by distance are predominant in most people's minds right now. So we do expect that we'll see some solutions that speak very specifically to some of the challenges that have occurred with COVID.
How big a response have you gotten from students in terms of, you know, the number of teams and students participating in years past?
Yeah, typically we end up with, oddly enough, kind of about the same number of teams, about 9 teams. Sometimes students register and then their work with their team just sort of doesn't pan out. So teams of about 2 to 5 typically have competed. This year we are allowing teams of 1 just because of the kind of unique year that we have, and that the competition this year will be a virtual competition, will be held virtually. And so we also really encourage students from all kinds of different disciplines to participate. And so we've just seen a wide range, students from computer science, students from engineering, human biology, psychology. We've even seen students from music, accounting, philosophy, design arts. So all kinds of students. And it's really exciting, especially when student teams have a mix of disciplines with which they're putting their team together. And so lots of different perspectives and how they're coming at their solution. It's really an exciting competition. And we don't know what this year will bring fully, but we're really looking forward to it.
And Susan, as you mentioned earlier, you were inspired by a similar project at another school. And I could imagine somebody out there listening, maybe at another college or maybe a high school teacher or community group member, thinking, hey, we could do something like this. What would you say to them about how to get a competition like this started?
It's pretty easy. And the thing that surprised us the most is that we thought students would be, have a little trepidation about competing. And what we really found is, you know, we have a group of students, young people that really are innovative and really think in entrepreneurial ways. And they've seen Shark Tank and, you know, they really come at this quite naturally. And we give them a fair amount of guidance. There's mentors if they want help. We have rules and a template to help them with their presentation. But in general, they acclimate to this process pretty naturally and I think more comfortably than we expected. So students are really amazing, and they come up with amazing ideas. And I'd say if other institutions want to do it, give it a try. You'll be surprised. And all of us that are part of the planning committee and competition, you know, we learn every year from students and the great ideas that they have.
Susan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Susan Gallagher-Lepak is Dean of the College of Health Education and Social Welfare at UW-Green Bay. We talked to her about the 5th Annual WISIS Innovation and Aging Student Idea Competition coming up next month. Up next, we'll hear from a Wisconsin professor who has created a handheld loom for weaving so you can spend more time working with your hands instead of, scrolling through social media. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, it's a new year and a new Congress, but what will the new Senate look like? That's all up to Georgia now. 1A looks at the Senate runoffs. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, we've talked a lot about the benefits of working with your hands on this show, from woodworking to knitting. But if the idea of committing to a big project or buying a lot of gear seems overwhelming, our next guest might have a place for you to start. She's created a mini handheld-sized loom for weaving, good for those who are fiber art fans and those who have never tried. Marianne Fairbanks is a textile artist and associate professor of design studies in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison. She runs a project called the Weaving Lab and launched Hello Loom to make her handheld loom design available to the public. Marianne, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. So great to be here.
Well, first, tell us what this mini loom looks like.
So the loom was modeled after my cell phone. So I have, I think I have an iPhone 8. So that was the original size inspiration. So I, you know, measured it up and said, if that fits in my pocket, it's the perfect size that I want people carrying around for their projects. And that was sort of where the inspiration began.
And you've brought in people to work on larger looms. And I get a sense from reading about this that they wanted an easy way to keep weaving without having to go and show up or buy lots of gear. Talk about people's hunger to do things with their hands.
Yeah, I had the Weaving Lab project first set up for in the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery back in 2016. And I think the looms, the vision of the floor looms really drew people in. And that was my hope, was that people could come in and spend a bit of time with us and do some weaving. But what I realized is that, you know, everyone's busy and people were very intrigued, but they couldn't stay. And so it occurred to me if I could hand someone something small enough and affordable enough that maybe they could just take the project with them. So that was the other inspiration, is how can I make this thing that's usually pretty clunky and not portable? You know, it's a pretty big investment of capital and material to start weaving. But here, if I could shrink it down, maybe I could send people out the door with their very own loom. And that's where the inspiration started.
How creative can we be with our mini loom?
Well, my hope is that, you know, that it can really appeal to people of every skill set. So the intro level, I think, is just the basic. And I think most people are at beginner stage, from kids, they'd say starting at maybe 5, can do something called a plane weave, which is over, under, over, under. And I see even from my own kids that they learned it in their elementary school. So that's the good news. And then from then on, what I love to explore is the idea of weaving as a binary pattern. So in weaving, we have two things. We have a warp and a weft, and the way that they intersect can create, you know, thousands of patterns, if not more. And so my hope is that people could start to sort of experiment with their own patterns and their own sort of messages in the colors and the patterns that they choose, and really develop their own sort of way of making, including textures and different themes. And so I always think the other way, reason I like to call it Hello Loom, is because we're weaving messages. So, you know, getting off the idea of texting and thinking quite literally about text and language, but thinking more conceptually about colors and sizes of yarn and different things that we could embed in the weaving itself, being the messages that we're making on this handheld loom.
Let's take a hypothetical person who's always been bad at doing stuff with their hands, you know, bad grades on scissors and pasting in elementary school. And, you know, they have a random job, like, I don't know, public radio host. Anyway, what would a person like that gain from an early experiment in weaving like this?
Well, I think anything that involves dexterity is a good sort of connection with your hand meeting your mind, right? So I think we're really needing that right now in this doom scrolling moment. And so anything that's sort of connecting your physical hand to what you're producing can be quite satisfying. And so I often have people say, well, what do I do with the little weaving that comes off the Hello Loom? And one of the things that's been designed into the loom is a stand. And so I love the idea that instead of maybe taking it off and piecing them together and having to create something large and wearable or useful, that we could actually sort of sit with it and not only enjoy the weaving process, but then put it in the stand and, you know, have it framed on your desk and sort of enjoy the products of your time and your efforts. And so I think that it should be accessible to even someone like you who might just, you know, connect with the idea of moving a line or moving different colors of string and creating different patterns. And so that is my hope, is that, you know, like puzzles or anything like that, that we do when we want to have a little bit of more mind and focus, that it will create that space in your mind to, feel a little more peaceful.
Talking to Mary Ann Fairbanks, textile artist, associate professor of design studies in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison. She runs the Weaving Lab and launched Hello Loom to make a handheld loom design available to the public. Mary Ann, you've touched on this a little bit. Can you talk some more about the value of, you know, for our brains, I think, of doing things, these focused activities with our hands?
Yeah, I love teaching workshops on the loom because it is something that you can achieve pretty quickly. And unlike maybe floor loom weaving, that is, again, like a lot of investment of skill where, you know, you need to learn all these things over time and then process the materials. The Hello Loom is a pretty immediate way to just jump in on any ideas that you have. So I've been really grateful to have used it for artists who are weavers, who might use the Hello Loom to prototype some ideas or do some color sampling. And so that's the other side, where people get really unconventional with what they try to put in there. So, for example, paper, you know, scraps of paper can become the weft material that you're going in and out with. Or recently, I started weaving a material called Tyvek, and that's something, again, it's like a very unconventional flat material, like a flat yarn, that maybe no one's tried before. And so that material I could even color on with markers and make messages or my own patterns by coloring the material by hand. And so again, I guess my goal is to spark the interest not only with the loom itself and the portability and the immediacy, but with new material projects and just options for people who might not have seen weaving that way before.
I've talked to artists and art educators, including Linda Berry, who I think you've worked with at the Institutes for Discovery. And I've heard the idea again and again that when we're kids, we're all artists. We're not self-conscious. We just do stuff. And then when we're grown-ups, we leave art to the artists, the official artists. Can you talk about the value of doing art, even if it's not going to end up at, I don't know, the Louvre or whatever?
Sure. I agree with Linda wholeheartedly. There's nothing that makes me more sad to hear people say, like, I can't do that, or I don't know how to draw. It's like, well, give it a chance, you know, be patient with yourself. And so I don't know when we lose that way of thinking and the patience towards our own dexterity. But what I find is that a lot of people these days, because we're on screens and we're on keyboards so much, they lose that dexterity of moving a yarn through other yarns or knitting. I teach all of these things in my classes at the UW, but our dexterity, it's kind of a failure when we learn how to fix things or accomplish or make things. But especially teaching online this past spring, I noticed that the students really loved having the class weaving, even though we had to move online, because it gave them a chance to connect with the physical and the real, you know, and to get off the digital screen that they were absorbed in for so many of their other classes. It was a real gift to be able to say, hey, go and spend some time doing this thing, spending time with material, making your ideas into something physical, three-dimensional. That's the other thing I love about weaving. It's a three-dimensional thing. It's not printing on another surface. It's creating something from the ground up. It's both image and structure. You know, by intersecting these yarns, we're sort of sculpting material into a three-dimensional form. So as you can see, there's a lot I get excited about with weaving, but I think you don't have to know much. And I love, you know, just weaving into things that you find at home too. It does not have to be complicated, honestly.
Now, getting back to the Hello Loom, I understand there's kind of a high-tech production tool you're using to make these guys. How do you make them?
So we use a laser cutter to make them. So the first prototypes, I was so excited to find a great reason to use a laser cutter because, again, we're fortunate at UW to have access to things like that, but I never had a reason to use it. And so finally it was like, oh, great. This gives me a way to use this technology to produce something I could distribute really affordably. And then since then, it's been really nice with the Hello Loom business because we decided we want to keep production local. So we use a company in Sun Prairie to produce our, because now we're, you know, going through hundreds of these and I can't cut them myself or anything, but it's laser cut. And all of the tools that you need, you know, except a scissors, are embedded right into the loom itself. So one of the fun parts of getting the loom is that you get it, it's all kind of one piece held together, and then you open it from its package and then you get to pop out the stand, and there's a comb and two needles embedded right in the design itself. And so that's something I'm really proud of, is that the design is something I thought, well, there's nothing else really like this. And so I worked with the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation, WARF, to get a design patent. And we just found out recently that we were awarded a patent. So we're pretty excited about that.
And briefly, Marianne, as we wrap up, if I open this up, do I get some instructions with it? Because I'd be pretty clueless on how to start my weaving.
Yes, absolutely. I have a business partner. Her name is Erica Hess, and she is a designer, and she has helped so tremendously with all of the website and the informational packet with your loom. So yes, we have loads of printed material that comes with your loom, but also we've made a number of YouTube tutorials. So if anyone's curious, they can head over to our website or our YouTube channel for Hello Loom and find ideas and projects and hopefully get started there as well.
Marianne, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Marianne Fairbanks is a textile artist and associate professor of design studies in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison. She runs a project called the Weaving Lab and launched Hello Loom to make her handheld loom design available to the public. We've got a link to more information at wpr.org/centraltime. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 7:30, the year-end spending and economic recovery bills passed by Congress include some measures aimed at turning the tide on climate change. Kate and her guests share the details. That's tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and from Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll talk to a psychologist about the concept of optimism bias, the COVID-19 pandemic, and what we can learn from our behavior during a crisis. Also, lessons on what we can learn about thinking about not just ourselves, but about society when we react to a big crisis. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.